bitch.
Mass Effect there. Hey, great restart, bud. Great job.
Wow, was that cold or what?
Second in front. Try to catch that group. Oh, why? I'm pushing like a hell.
It is undrivable. There's puddles, aquaplaning everywhere. Unbelievable.
Behind you, very close. Okay, okay, Anna. He's fast, okay, Timo, keep going, he's fast. He's in front,
hold on.
And in sunshine, well done, well done. Pole position, fastest lap, and the race win. Job done, job done. Take that.
Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the PlanetIRL.com podcast. This week I'm joined by Lisa and Paul, our IndyCar editor and our webmaster, and we're going to discuss some IndyCar here first, including a Kentucky review and some of the headlines and our predictions for next week. First off, a big congrats to Ed Carpenter on his great run this weekend and all the Vision crew. It was really a good feel-good story, and he was flying all night, and I just wanted to get Lisa's and Paul's opinion on him and what he accomplished this week, and we'll start off with Lisa on that.
Yeah, I think hands down, Kentucky was the best race we've seen on ovals so far this year. Could not be happier for Ed Carpenter and the entire Vision team. They did a fantastic job. I think it was probably about halfway through that he kind of overtook and, you know, came into P1, and just amazing what we saw side-by-side action all weekend long. And Ed really did such a great job holding Briscoe off. You know, I think a lot of us can say it's a little bit of a shame that Penske ended up winning in the long run. No offense to the Penske crew. They definitely always put on a good show, but it was just so amazing to see Ed come flying up and really kind of own the end of that race, in my opinion. So kudos to him and to the whole team for really giving us what I think all of us Indy fans have been longing for this whole season to date. So just an amazing race. It was so great with all the changes. I think a bunch of us were skeptical when we first heard the announcements on how push to pass was going to work and all the changes with the wickers and the downforce, and I think that team really stepped up, and I mean it was amazing being there and just seeing, I mean, honestly, passing and good old fashioned racing. So congrats to Briscoe for the win, but Ed just gave them a run for their money, so it was awesome.
And of course, Lisa and I were in attendance there, and we'll tell you about some of our experiences later. And I just want to say that Ed Carpenter, we kind of dogged on him last week and gave him the chicane award, but he really showed what he can do on a 1.5 mile oval. And as soon as he started, he was just quick right out of the box and was overtaking right there. And so Paul, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, it's a shame that the next two races have to be on road courses before we get back to Chicago. Poor Ed, probably up for the Chicane of the Week award next week, except for Milka being back on the road course. But Ed was just unbelievable this weekend. The whole Vision crew really was second to none the whole weekend. The guys gave them great pit stops. I was yelling at the TV the whole time that he shouldn't take tires on his last pit stop, but they took tires, and I mean that crew just nailed it. Just from the start of the race, he was fast on the last restart. Kind of got lucky on the last restart that Scott Dixon jumped that last restart, and had to give up the positions he gained. And in that, Ed was kind of able to take advantage of that and get up right on Will Power. But Ed was the class of the field all night, and he really deserved the win. It would have been a great win for the series. Again, nothing against Ryan Briscoe at all, but nobody was rooting against Ed that I've heard of. It would have been a great story. It was great to see them up there, and hopefully the Vision guys can continue doing it the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm. And Lisa touched on earlier the passing that we saw was second to none this year. And it brought us back to the what I call the good old days of IndyCar racing back in the 01 to 05 era there. And I think the push to pass was kind of the gimmick, and it less than 1% increase when you're at full rich is not going to do much. But the wickers and the tires, and they still have a little bit of problem with the graining, but overall their changes are good, and I think they should do more of them and speed them up more and make more passing. So.
And I think just being there in the stands, and I mean, honestly, just seeing literally guys going lap after lap, just side by side, was, I just think, the highest point of that race. It was amazing.
And I don't know if Firestone brought a new compound to this race or not, but it didn't seem the marbles were as bad this week as they have been on some of the ovals this year and over the past couple of years. You had the two cases where Briscoe about twice threw it in the fence, Dario about threw it in the fence, and Elio about threw it in the fence. All three times they were able to, you know, they lost positions, had to get out of it, but none of them ended up, you know, knocking the wall down. There was a second groove the entire race. It didn't look like the drivers were scared to get up on top. So, you know, credit to Firestone for bringing a tire that didn't seem to marble as bad as it has over the last couple of years.
And you mentioned something there that the drivers weren't afraid to get in the top lane, and we talked about this before we started recording on our little pre-chat we have. I think one of the things that's really hurting passing is not the cars at all. I think it's the drivers are, they're just kind of, they don't want to pass. They figure that they can just out-pit strategy someone and they don't have to pull out and do something dangerous like we would see Sam Hornish do back at Texas in the good old days and just put it all the way up to the wall and try to pass. So I think they need to... You can't really change the drivers, but if you can change the tracks in the cars to help the drivers do more, it'll help.
I agree, and one of the things I remember earlier in my day of following Indy, which wasn't too long ago, but, you know, I do want to give a shout-out to Thomas Schechter, because I remember even when he was at Ganassi and then moved on, you know, some of his moves I would think would be very aggressive, but you brought up a good point, Cole, that at the end of the day, you know, the drivers need to push it and give it their all. It's come down, you know, to what we've seen a little bit, I think, to the point where, you know, maybe they are just trying to stay in the formation and not wreck into anything and not do any kind of crazy moves. But at the end of the day, to me, that's not really racing anyway. It's like, come on, push it. I mean, we can all laugh with NASCAR where, you know, they have the phrase rubbing is racing. And while we can't really do that in Indy, obviously, at 220 open wheel, I think you did bring up a good point that, you know, come on, there's so much the cars can do, but, you know, the drivers need to be a little bit aggressive. I mean, still smart, but, you know, just get outside of that mentality of, hey, you know, I'm in second right now. I'm not going to try to do something to mess that up. I mean, second's not a good example. Maybe more if you were in 10th, but you know what I mean? Just get a little bit more aggressive, but still safe at the same side.
Mm-hmm. And I think, go ahead, Paul.
Well, you were talking about those years, the 2001, the 2005, 2006, in that you would run these mile-and-a-half ovals, whether you were Kansas or Chicago or Texas, anywhere you would go to, you know, they would be running two by two for five, six, eight rows deep on lap 60. And it didn't make sense why they were risking the car that early. And I think as the drivers have evolved and gotten more used to the oval racing, you've just got a sense that they realize that doesn't do anything for anyone. It doesn't help them win the race to be running two and three wide that early in the race. It helps them to get in line, single file, try to break away from a pack and sort it out the last 30, 40, 50 laps. And really that's what we saw here again at Texas. They were at Kentucky this weekend. They were able to run side by side. They went side by side when they needed the pass, but they weren't running side by side on lap 50, lap 60, lap 80, just for the heck of it, which is different than what we saw 6, 8 years ago. And I think that's probably more what we're going to see from here on out, is they're going to spend the first 150 laps of the race getting to the last 50. And the last 50 are where we're going to see them shoot it out, just like we did in Kentucky this weekend. And I think that's just the way the IRL drivers have evolved. And really, it's smarter for them to make sure their equipment is there when the points are actually paid out. Because points aren't paid out at lap 50. It's when lap 200 comes that they have to make it to that point.
Mm-hmm. I disagree a little bit, though. I mean, sitting there in person, I wasn't watching the broadcast, but I think early on, I mean, even with, you know, Dixon battling it out and then, you know, Carpenter and Power, we saw, I mean, lap after lap of just constant side by side. And that to me was awesome.
Oh, I agree. It's awesome to see. Last year at Chicagoland was absolutely unreal, where they ran 3x3. Two or three rows deep, three wide for two or three laps. I remember Weldon was running up there a line that, I mean, hadn't been run on since Dale Earnhardt Jr. went rim riding there in a NASCAR. I mean, he was way out there. But again, it was right around mid-race, and it doesn't make sense to risk putting your car in the wall that early in the race. And I will
agree with that, but it was fun for the fans to see
from
early.
A fan standpoint, absolutely. It's exciting and breathtaking, but we're not the ones paying the repair bills either.
Yeah, I'm sure the sponsors wouldn't like my last comment.
Well, and that mentality also this weekend, waiting till the end to get side by side, also led to the first race that I can think of for a really long time on an oval that didn't have any crashes. There was no contact except for Briscoe's little brush of the wall off four there. There were no crashes, only one caution for Wilson. I don't know what the problem was exactly yet. I haven't watched the rebroadcast of the race, but no crashes, and everybody was really clean except for the pit road incident, which I was watching right when it happened, and you could tell that was going to happen because they let Conway out too early, but I think it was a good, clean race, and it showed what a race should be like on an oval.
And I want to just point out, too, I mean, as we were talking earlier, that's pretty amazing when you think that they had absolutely no real practice time, no qualification. So I think with all these changes, which were new to the drivers this weekend, I mean, I just want to reiterate, amazing job for everybody that, I mean, really, they went out there at the end of the day, there were no incidents, and yeah, that's brilliant.
And a couple other little items from Kentucky. Ganassi did not have a car in the top 10.
Top five.
And I know, as Lisa just cheered for that, not all of us are big Ganassi fans, and we'd like to see some difference at the top, but I think that's really a sign that maybe the changes they made can invert the field a little and bring different people to the top.
Well, geez, he got AGR in the top three. What's that say?
I know. And Marias led the whole practice session, so on an oval, and then he did something stupid, I believe. But
yeah, that was pretty cool.
I think
practice, anyway.
It did shake up the field a lot, and I think it did help. So am I missing anything from the Kentucky race, or should we move on to some headlines?
I think we got it all. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the IRL definitely responded to what we all have wanted to see this season, which is some racing, and I think we absolutely got it in Kentucky, so kudos to everybody involved.
And it's good to see the league actually listening to the fans and not just ignoring us. They listen to our suggestions, and they listen to our opinions, and they really listen, and they really kind of took them to heart and fixed it as quick as they could there. So we'll move on to some of the headlines from this week in IndyCar. First up, Tagliani is no longer with Conquest Racing, and Matsura will fill in for him starting at Motegi. I wanted to get your opinions on what you think this does for Tagliani and Conquest. I thought it was a great matchup, and I thought Alex was doing the best he could there, and Matsura's probably bringing money because he was never the most talented driver in the field.
Well, after Tagliani replaced Enrique Bernoldi last year, that team really seemed like they fit well and they gelled together. And even this year, starting the year, they looked pretty good. But after about 3 o'clock on bump day at Indianapolis, where Eric Bachelard left Tagliani in the qualifying line, and he got bumped. It's just been downhill for that team ever since then. They had a good run in the 500, you know, with Rookie of the Year coming from 33rd to 11th, a nice run there. But really, they've been a pretty much a non-factor with the exception of Toronto this year, and I think everyone expected them to look better at Edmonton and look better at Watkins Glen, but it just hasn't had the results this year. And the scathing article that Alex Tagliani put out talking about his discussion made it pretty clear, at least from his standpoint, that he didn't think the team was committed to winning, to doing what they needed to do to advance. So there were certainly some internal struggles there. And probably when you get to that point, I think it's better for both parties to go their separate ways, and hopefully we'll see Alex back in a ride soon. He's a good driver, and I hope he has another shot at it.
And I do want to make a note before Lisa chimes in here with Alex. If you guys listened to episode 2 and read the article I posted about it, I told you that we would have a former Indy 500 Rookie of the Year on, and it was going to be Alex Tagliani, but he got unceremoniously dumped, so that didn't work out. So, and I never really explained that, and I want to apologize for not filling you in on that situation. I'll throw it back to Lisa here and get her opinion on Tagliani and Conquest.
No, I think Paul said it best. I mean, it really is a shame. I remember, as most of you know, I started out watching Champ Car, and I mean, I agree. Tagliani is a great driver. We saw some good runs with him, with your boy PT, and even with Seb Cole. And I mean, it's just a shame that, you know, they kind of ditched him early on or whatever the case may be. I don't think that necessarily he's had a strong run in Indy, but I think given time, as we've seen with a lot of these guys, especially since the unification, it is a bit of a switch, and it's just a shame that they cut him out very fast. And, you know, hopefully we'll definitely see more of him. I think he's got, you know, some talent, and it would be good to just foster that. Didn't really follow Matsura too much, so don't have too many comments on that, but, we love you, Alex, so hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned my boy, LeSeb. Credit to Todd from F1V for making that name. That's not mine, so talk to him if you agree or disagree with that name. He is rumored to be taking over Dornbos' seat either late this year or next year. I've heard rumors that he was at the shop today getting fitted for a seat, and I've heard also that Dornbos is already out and he won't be here next week, and I wholeheartedly agree with that, of course, because I'm a big Bourdais fan and I don't like Robert at all. And he can take his daddy's money and go over to HVM because he won't win there either, because he's not talented and Bourdais is. So while I'll send it off to Paul here and let him start on this one.
Wow, I had to follow that. I certainly wouldn't go so far as to say that Dornbos doesn't have talent. He was fast his first oval test at Homestead. He put the car on the outside of the front row at Kansas. Unfortunately, he had a couple of thumps at Indy that really set him back, I think. And I don't think he's really recovered since those big accidents there. I think those were his first real taste of American Wall, and I just don't think he's really recovered since those big accidents. He looked so good to start the year. He obviously had a great year in Champ Car in 2007, and I expected a lot more out of him this year, but just hasn't materialized. I don't know if with the Newman Haas Lanigan, if he's getting equal treatment there, if Graham is. There's been some rumors that Graham may be getting some preferential treatment. I have no way of knowing whether he is or not, but it's something just isn't clicking at Newman Haas Lanigan with Robert Dornbos. So if he indeed does go to HVM, which, by the way, I don't see that happening for this weekend. It just seems like a quick turnaround, something they may need a bit more time. And actually, I would be a little bit surprised to see Sebastian probably in that ride the rest of the year, given that there are still 3 ovals left this year. He doesn't have a lot of experience on the ovals, and he's actually come out and said several times he's not a big fan of racing on the ovals. So putting him on the, especially at Chicago this year, that, you know, really races like a mile and a half. The Motegi and Homestead are a little bit different, but Chicago, especially coming up at the end of the month, that would be a tough one to throw Sebastian in on. But I think next year, I think there's a good chance he'll end up at Newman Haas Lane again next year.
And I've said that from the beginning, that he I know personally that he was going to NHL this year, and when STR called him back up, he dumped that, and Bobby D got the ride late like he did. And you said something about the oval racing. I know he's driven at Motegi and Milwaukee, at least, in Champ Car. I wasn't familiar with their oval schedule, but I know he did those two.
He ran the two races at Las Vegas as well. I know he won one of them, but I didn't, at least one of them. He may have won both of them, but I don't remember exactly how those raced, although I do know that, what was it, 2004, 2005, somewhere in there, and they went to Las Vegas with the road course wing package to avoid the same situation they had at
Texas.
So I don't know whether a Lola road course setup, how that would compare to a Dallara Speedway setup.
Well, he ran the Panos for NHL at Indy in 2005 and finished 12th. He was involved in Danica's spin. Sorry, little Donald Davidson moment there. But he was doing pretty good in 2005 at the 500.
He was doing well. It wasn't the Danica spin. He crashed on lap 198 and brought out that last yellow that, mm-hmm. that actually allowed Danica to finish the race.
I knew it had something to do with Danica.
Yeah. But that's right. He does have that experience. So, I mean, he has driven the old G-Force at Indy. But again, Indy doesn't race anything like any of the other tracks, and especially doesn't race like Chicago.
It doesn't, and would you even, I mean, I might almost even argue a little bit, sorry, Cole, but, you know, just given the F1 and then Champ Car prior to that, you know, I mean, we're talking a few years back, do you think he would be, you know, that brought up into speed to just jump right into, say, the current schedule?
And he also, well, to argue that point, which you knew I was going to, because that's what I do, he's always been good in the sports cars, and they drive a lot more like an Indy car than they do an F1 car because they're heavier and taller, and F1 cars are low, light, and the steering is very light on them. So I think if he does it, I think he will be good, especially on the road courses, and I think he'll come to the ovals. If they can get Graham Rahal up to speed and get a pole on an oval, they can get Bourdais up to speed on an oval. Come on.
And Graham did that pretty fast, I must admit. I think, not to digress a little bit, but I think Graham picked up pretty quick on the oval, so.
Don't
Graham picked up how to qualify on the oval very quickly.
Yeah, this is true.
Other than, now, he raced a hell of a race this past weekend. I was shocked when, you know, 160 laps, I wasn't paying attention, and all of a sudden Graham Rahal is up in fourth or fifth spot, and I had no idea how he got there. But he's been an expensive driver on ovals to this point. He's struggled. He did well at Milwaukee on the short oval, but again, the mile and a half ovals have not been his friend. He's had some tough runs on the mile and a half so far, and so I wouldn't say they've got him, well, hadn't had him up to good racing standard. I think he's kind of figured it out now, and I think he's having fun with it now based on what he said after Kentucky as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if they can get Sebastian up there right away, it's a different animal for him.
Yeah, I would just almost comment back, Cole, that I'm wondering with Sebastian Bourdais being gone for a little while, more familiar with F1 and with the street courses, how he would fare coming into the current IndyCar schedule.
And I think that the sports cars he's done over the years has really shown what he can do in an IndyCar, because they drive more like an Indy car than an F1 car, because the steering is heavier and they're a little heavier and taller. And I think if they can get him up to speed, that he'll do great. So I want to see him back, because who am I supposed to root for? Zach Lazier or something? But I need a fan, or I need a driver to be a fan for, and I think he's the guy. And I'd like to see him back because he does have a personality, and we have a lot of doorknobs in the series. And if we get him back and we get PT back, this will just be epic.
I am, for one, calling for a Sebastian Bourdais, Paul Tracy showdown next year at either Toronto or Edmonton.
Yeah.
And I will be there.
And now we're on to the awards segment and the predictions of the IndyCar segment of the podcast. We have four awards here on the podcast. The Whiner of the Week, the Eddie Cheever Lunacy Award, the Marty Roth Award for Excellence in Chicanery, and the most coveted award, the Driver of the Week. First off is the Whiner of the Week Award. After a lot of debate over who whined the most this weekend, we've decided not to give it to one person, but to the entire Planet IRL Twitter tribe and all of our Twitter followers and basically everyone in the IndyCar racing world that's on Twitter, because all day Friday we all sat on there and whined and whined and whined about why they can't get the track dry and how stupid they must be because they can't sop up water seeping out of a concrete or asphalt racetrack. It can't be that hard. And we learned just how hard it is, and Paul is going to inform us more about that here in a bit. But
and I do want to just add real quick, Cole, because I was actually sitting there Friday all excited to go to qualifying and, you know, got to the track and literally just scratched my head for about 2 hours before I left.
Uh-huh. We did a lot of whining, and I was texting Lisa while she was there telling her about all the whining that was going on and on.
That's the good thing about leaving your laptop behind. You don't see it all.
And I sent all of her whining out to our tribe. And the next award is Paul's, and he'll tell you what it is and explain it for you.
The Eddie Cheever Lunacy Award follows up on the Whiners Award. It goes to the Kentucky Speedway engineers and the staff that put together the track and made apparently no drainage in the track at this facility. It really is a shame that a facility as nice as Kentucky would not have adequate drainage in there. As a pavement engineer myself, I realize it's not that difficult to do. Even with the way Kentucky is kind of built below ground, there are ways to do that. And on the flip side of that, kudos to Bruton Smith and the folks from SMI for taking charge. And hopefully, they're saying within the month they'll start construction to get this resolved. So hopefully we shouldn't see any more of these issues. And hopefully for the poor folks in Kentucky, they won't have 7 inches of rain next year, the week before the race either.
And I live I live far, but we have the same weather, and it poured all week, and that track, if you've never been there, it's built in a bowl. When you walk in, you have to go down to get to the grandstand, so it was not laid out well and not designed well, so they get this week's Eddie Cheever Lunacy Award. Our next award, Lisa will give away, and she'll tell you what it is and explain it.
All right, so next up is the Marty Roth Chicanery Award, and I need to go into a little bit of a Danica reminiscent vent, and I am going to give it this week to Milka Dunno, who flat out is a menace on the IndyCar track. I don't think anybody can argue with me on that. She really needs to step aside, either keep up with the big boys or get off the track. I think we saw her in traffic blocking pretty much every single leader and every single person trying to get around her. So, Milka Dunno, congratulations. You get the Marty Roth Chicanery Award.
Thanks for butchering the Duno there. Milk and Donuts gets the Marty Roth Award for Excellence in Chicanery this week. Our next award and final award is the Driver of the Week. This week, it was not very hard to tell, and if you've listened to the beginning of the podcast already, you know pretty much who we're going to pick, and this week it's going to be Ed Carpenter. He really, and last week he did get the Marty Roth Award for Excellence Chicanery, but this week he is going to get the Driver of the Week because he did put on quite a show, and it really did show us what he's made of on ovals and prove that the oval drivers out there can do it too. So this week, Ed, you get the Marty Roth Award, the Driver of the Week Award from PlanetIRL.com.
Yay! Go, Ed!
So we'll move on to the final part of the IndyCar segment here, and that's our predictions for next week at Mid-Ohio. We pick our first, second, and third finishers and our driver to watch, and then we keep score on that. And as the year goes on, we'll update you on our scores and who's picking the best. So we'll start out with Lisa and her picks.
All right, I do want to precede my picks with, we did have a verbal agreement that we were not going to pick red cars in Ohio, which, as you all know, is pretty much a long shot. But with that spirit in mind, I am going to go with no red cars, except for I'm going to call Wilson. This may not be in an order, but I'll give Wilson, even though, you know, hey, he'll get it. We'll give him the win. I am going to pick Ray Hall for P2. That is a red car. However, it is not affiliated with Penske or Ganassi. Just happens to be his livery with McDonald's. So Wilson, Ray Hall, and then I'm going to go with Tony Kanaan, the Tiki Torch himself. Think he'll do a great job with AGR. And, you know, with that spirit in mind of no red cars, I will proclaim my driver to watch as Ryan Briscoe, who I secretly think will probably win it. But, hey, we're going with the no red car theme, so here we go.
I love how we said no red cars, and you picked three of your four red cars. But
so that's all right. Hey, Wilson, Ray Hall, Kanaan, watch Briscoe.
Mm-hmm. And, Paul, your picks for this week?
Well, first off, I'll go with the Tiki Torch as well. You know, he tried to set the world on fire at the last road course, performed well at Kentucky, and I think he'll continue his hot streak at Mid-Ohio this week. Second to watch is Dornbos. He's kind of been lost the last few weeks, but I think he's going to figure things out at Mid-Ohio, and he'll look pretty strong. My third guy is going out on a limb here. I think Rafa Matos will have a good weekend. He likes the road courses. He performs well there. I think he'll do well. Guy to watch for the weekend, just because he usually causes a handful of accidents, and it's always fun to watch. Be watching for unlucky number 13, EJ Viso, this weekend.
Oh, EJ. Hey, I met him in Kentucky. Super nice guy.
Yes, you kind of stalked him at Kentucky, but we'll get into that story later when we do a review of our adventures from the Kentucky Speedway. And now my predictions for this week at Mid-Ohio. For number one, oh, by the way, I forgot about that whole red car rule, and I picked red cars. For number one, I picked Dario Franchitti because he needs a comeback, and I think it's going to come this week. And I think he'll do well, and he's always performed well at these high-speed road courses. For second, I have Graham Ray Hall, and I know Phil will kill me later for saying that because he's not a big Ray Hall fan. And third, I have Justin Wilson. That's pretty much self-explanatory because he's always flying on the road courses. My driver to watch is Mike Conway because he was doing pretty well at Watkins Glen. And he's always pretty fast on road courses as well if he can just keep the tires on the track. I think that just about wraps up the IndyCar segment. You guys want to give any shout-outs or have anything else to say?
Well, I would say it's a shame that Cole just disqualified himself from this week's PlanetIRL.com fantasy racing, but that's all right. You can rejoin us next week.
Well, not only that, but he kind of went against the whole not picking a Ganassi or a Penske.
Yeah.
So, hey, at least me and Paul went with the rules.
That's
hey,
right.
I'm the boss. I make the rules. And the
if
rules
I need
say,
to redo my picks for the real winner.
No. I'm the boss. I make the rules. And I say, I'm picking Dario to win this week at Mid-Ohio.
Well, you know, if Dario wins, we have to watch Ashley Judd get interviewed on TV.
Okay, right? I take that back. We'll take Dario off. Yes. I want to thank Lisa and Paul for joining me here for the IndyCar segment of the PlanetIRL.com podcast. And be sure to check in and see their ramblings and news on PlanetIRL.com on the IndyCar tab. We'll now move on to an F1 segment. And now we're going to begin the F1 segment of the PlanetIRL.com podcast. I have with me today Sean, our buddy from over at OpenPaddock.net, and a returning star to the F1 segment here on Planet IRL, Dex Brennan from Midweek Motorsport, and my name is IRL.com. How are you today, guys?
Very good, thank you.
I'm fantastic, thank you very much.
We're just going to discuss some F1 news and happenings over the last week with you, and there have been a lot of them, so we'll go ahead and just jump right in. And the first one is a new Concorde agreement has been signed for the 2012 season. a lot of teams have really wanted us to bring power back to a central group and not just to Max and Bernie. So I wanted to get your take on what you think this will do and if you like it or not. So we'll go ahead and start out with Sean and get his opinion on the 2012 Concord Agreement.
Well, I do think it's great, finally, to have a Concord Agreement. As you've seen, a lot of the problems that we've had, that the series has had over the last couple of years has been because of a lack of a Concord Agreement. And I think now that we have one, we can finally try to get some stability in the rules and just make sure that we got some people around and not jumping ship. I think it's definitely a positive thing, finally.
And over to Dex for his political insight on the Concord Agreement.
I like the idea that you think it'll take some power away from Max and Bernie. I think that's quite a unique concept. I don't think it'll take any power away from them at all. I think that is the whole point of this. And the signing of the Concord Agreement, unfortunately, is the final end game in Bernie maintaining control. And this is the thing that we talked about on our show at a time about the split. The only winner in all of this between the teams who potentially were going to, the photo teams are going to break away and the FIA and Max, etc. The only winner in all of this either way would have been Bernie. And Bernie is the winner in all of this because Bernie has all of the important rights. He still controls everything. It's to some extent, I maintain from the very start that it's breaking away would have been turkeys voting for Christmas because they would have ended up spiraling their costs out of control, despite what they would have said about wanting to cut them. I think the only good thing about the Concord Agreement is, and with sort of all of the discussions that have been going on previously, is that we might see some semblance of a proper cost control, not cost capping, perish the thought, but a more sensible approach to spending, although it's hard to see that really coming anytime soon. But as I said, Bernie will be rubbing his hands, and I really don't think the Concord Agreement is going to make any significant difference to the grand scheme of things and the power structure in F1, and don't think it's going to make that much difference to the people you're going to see at the front end of the grid week in, week out.
Well, I wouldn't, as you mentioned at the beginning of that platitude there, for lack of better words, you mentioned that it would put more power in the hands of Bernie, and I would much rather see Bernie have power than Max have power, because I think Bernie does more than Max, not, a lot, but more than Max, look out for the teams a little more, and just doesn't worry about the bottom line, and I know that's what he's famous for, but he's not as bad as Bernie on that.
I would beg to differ. I would beg to differ. Bernie is the reason that F1 is disappearing up its own backside, because Bernie, due to his alarming sanctioning fees, the fact that you can't, a promoter, if you're a promoter of a Grand Prix, there's only, no matter any way you promote a racing event, there's only a certain number of ways that you can recoup your money, and that's obviously through ticket sales, through merchandise, through corporate entertainment, through the on-track advertising. An F1 race, Bernie charges an enormous sanctioning fee. You can't recoup any of your money through on-track advertising because Bernie controls that. He also controls the paddock club, so he controls all of the corporate entertainment. The only way you can really make your money back is through the ticket prices. And therefore, Bernie's sanctioning fees and Bernie's policies mean ticket prices for F1 are astronomical, which means he is constantly on the lookout for new countries to go to and new venues that will get underwritten by governments, which means that it's almost becoming impossible for a regular country and a regular track to promote and put an event on. One of the reasons there's no event in North America at the moment. One of the reasons I'm still relatively skeptical about whether Montreal will come back. So the idea that Bernie, yes, he has been good for the teams, but Bernie's been really good for Bernie. Don't lose sight of that.
I agree there. You mentioned Montreal. They've been rumored to be back on the schedule next year or the year after. I would much rather see them come back than all of these newer Asian Abu Dhabi-esque tracks. And you mentioned
in all fairness, you have to admit there's something rather fascinating about the track in Abu Dhabi, a track where some of the runoff area goes under the grandstands. I really, really like that idea.
I can just see massacres happening now.
I as soon as I read about that, I thought, actually, it looks sensational, the Abu Dhabi track, I have to say, and with the pit exit coming from underground and that sort of thing. There's some lovely, curious, or the curiosity in me means I'm definitely going to be tuning in for the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. Whether or not it's going to be a great track is another matter, but there's enough weird, quirky bits that will make me want to watch that race. But I think in general you're right about there are talks about Bulgaria now and Hungary, or I'm sorry, Bulgaria and Korea and India and all sorts of other places. And that's unfortunately is a byproduct of the whole business model that Bernie has. And of course that Bernie is in some ways forced to, because the shareholders are owed so much money. So carry on.
Well, go ahead, Sean.
I agree. You're going to get this kind of stuff just because of the way the business model is and how, kind of loose it is. And I think, but unfortunately for that, I think that the legacy events are events that need to be either brought back or kept, for obvious reasons. There's huge fan base there. And, we expanded to countries like China a few years back. Now they're having a hard time, even filling the grandstands at the race. And then we move on to places like, Silverstone, where this past year, they were packed, packed to the brim with fans. And now, the whole British GP kind of idea is in somewhat of a state of limbo with the Donington Silverstone thing. But I think, I think the places like Spa, like Silverstone, like Montreal, and all that, I think those are have-to-haves on the circuit. Even if you want to, expand to some of these other countries, I for one especially thought China would be a nice place to have, a Grand Prix. The track's pretty cool, but it's just not selling at all. And I'm hoping that, we don't have to keep hopping around the globe every few years, because now, attendance is bad at this track at China, so we're going to drop it and we're going to move to South Korea. Well, South Korea was booming for a year and then South Korea falls off, and stuff like that. I mean, even in Japan, where there's a pretty good, pretty good motorsport kind of following, it's just, not even the ticket sales there are as good as they could be, and they're all, just kind of bouncing back and forth between Fuji and Suzuka and all that. So, it's just, I guess, like Dex said, the business model is just hurting it really bad.
Well, so. Just on the subject of China, news has just come out this week that the Chinese round of the Le Mans series Asian Le Mans series has been cancelled. So the Asian Le Mans series is down to one race at Autopolis. China, there isn't an appetite, there isn't a market for you can't fill grandstands in China. You can't do it in Turkey either. The Turkish people aren't really interested. There's no culture. It's one of these things. There's no culture of racing in those countries, and therefore people aren't going to flock in the numbers. But then, for a while longer, Bernie will be able to find places that will governments will underwrite to get Grand Prix, and he's losing the places where there is no, government underwriting. And one of the things he said today, by the way, which is quite interesting, is that he said if Donington doesn't happen, he'll happily go back to Silverstone. So I think he's mellowing on the whole idea of Silverstone, even though he has talked down Silverstone for years and years. So
yeah, and it's pretty bad when you consider something like Saipang to be a legacy track. It's one of the older tracks on the schedule now, so that really shows how much has changed with the schedule as of late.
Mm-hmm.
And moving on from the track debate there, there are also some driver news, of course, with Ferrari. Massa was released and he's back in Brazil now, and Schumacher has been didn't get to test, and his fitness and his neck injury might cause problems in his race. So I wonder.
That's not going to happen. No, it won't. As it was pointed out by Nick Damon on our show today, he said the idea that any driver who would do 65 to 70 laps at Mugello in a car who hasn't driven one of them in anger in the amount of time he has and who would get out and not feel sore would be a superhuman. So I don't think it's going to stop him racing. Mm-hmm. There is no way on earth that Massa, irrespective of what Massa wants, Massa can't get back in the car. Massa has a major head injury. And it's just, it's like in football, you know, when a guy gets a concussion, it just accelerates the chance and exacerbates the problem of getting more concussions. So he's got to be very careful about his return.
Yep, I agree with Felipe. I mean, his head, I mean, he had two fractures on his head. There's no chance that, you know, if he was smart, which he is, you know, matured, but I think even the hit to the head has been a bit impaired his judgment, because to think that you're going to get back in the car this year after something like that, you know, especially with his family situation, he'd be best probably just to sit out the rest of the year and get back in the car, you know, at the start of next year for the testing and everything. And as far as with Schumacher, I also agree there's no way that a little bit of neck pain is, you know, is going to keep him, is going to sway his decision to get back in the car. It needs, I mean, they've already announced it. They're already going through the plans. I mean, you know, it just, he had to know that there was a chance that there may be some pain. And like you said, you'd have to be superhuman not to have neck pain after not being in the car for, you know, 16 months or something like that. So, I mean, he hasn't been in the car a while, so just, he just needs to run some more, I think, and he'll be fine. The medical part should not hopefully be a problem, and I will be personally looking forward to watching him in Valencia.
Yeah. If you saw the pictures of Massa today, his face, I don't think he's going to drive at all, even in testing at all this season. And I'd be doubtful for early next season. It looks like he might have to have some sort of reconstructive surgery or something of that nature, because the whole left side of his face is very damaged. And I heard somewhere that he was cleared for Brazil to race, but I know that's not going to happen. I'm fairly certain Schumacher will finish out the season for him, and I don't disagree with that. I'd like to see Schumacher back, and F1 is definitely hyping it up. If you looked at their website early this week, they've already taken it down, but if you saw it earlier this week, the entire site was clad in Ferrari red, and his face was the header banner of the site. So I think they're doing a little bit of subliminal advertising there.
Well, what's interesting as well about his comeback is, and especially if it's prolonged, is that the help it'll give Ferrari with regards to the development of next year's car, because they will effectively have 6 months of on-track testing and feedback from Schumacher that they haven't had for a year, you know, since, because obviously he would have done the bulk of the testing over the years and been the developer of all of their best cars, obviously working very closely with Ross Brawn. But what they have now is really, because he's obviously not trying to win a world title, but they have an amazing opportunity here, even if he only comes back temporarily for the second half of this year, to get an unbelievable amount of feedback and get a jump on the competition for next year to have such an unbelievable tester in the car.
Yeah, when the Moss accident first happened, I was hesitant to post anything on our site at Open Paddock, but one of the things that I did mention in one of the forums was, you know, I think that Schumacher would be the best option because all the circumstances are perfect for why he would come back to race. He said when he retired, the only time he would, you know, even think of getting in the car is if the pressure of the race weekend was not there. That's why I liked testing so much. Well, I mean, obviously, Michael, you're not going to be running for a championship this year. You just, you know, simply use that second car as a test bed, try to get a good jump on 2010. And, I mean, you've already put 2010 parts on your car last weekend, and it ran with great pace for the track. and, you know, just put those, continue to add some parts, get that testing. And I mean, it's kind of like a, little loophole in the rules. I mean, because, you know, they're going to be testing that car for 6 months without a care in the world, or, you know, not 6 months, but the rest of the races anyways, and then into the next season. And they're just going to be testing it and not worrying about, you know, not really having to worry about a strong finish. And, you know, he's the best one suited with the slick tires. Granted, he does have some, you know, he hasn't drove these exact specifications, but the slick tires, the narrow car, the low downforce kind of cars, he's been in them before. There's no reason to think that he can't offer you good, you know, good testing information for next year's car, and I would definitely see them, for next year. So,
well, put it this way, Kimi is mentally checked out. He wants to do other things. He really, he clearly isn't bothered anymore. I could easily see this being his last year. So, if they're going to get any, you know, genuine proper effort in terms of development and feedback, it's going to come from Schumacher. Kimi doesn't seem to be bothered about anything else, maybe except rallying and doing powerboat rides dressed as a monkey. So it's a peculiar thing to say, and obviously it's one of the best things that could have happened to the team this year, because bizarrely with an eye on 2010, but it's very interesting, and clearly they will be approaching the race weekends with a little eye on development for next year as well. It's not about just winning races, although I think that Schumacher being the ultimate competitor, that's all he'll be there to do. You know, he's not there to make the numbers, I'll put it that way.
And I do actually have a short question for you, Dex, and this is kind of out of left field, a left field kind of question. But if he does finish out the rest of the year and we do see Kimi leave, granted, I know we see you know, a lot of rumors about Alonso in the car for 2010, perhaps, or, you know, a bunch of silly season rumors that are out there. What if Schumacher comes back and is competitive in the F60 with the 2010 parts? What do you think would be the chances of perhaps maybe coming back for another championship? Even though it is, you know, obviously out of left field, and he said he's done, but is there any way that he may change his mind if he gets in back into the groove?
I cannot honestly see, with the track record Alonso has of throwing his dolls out of the pram when anybody else gets even remotely similar treatment, I cannot see the idea of Alonso going there. I cannot see him going there. And embracing the team with Schumacher in it, and to be perfectly honest, vice versa, I think it's not a recipe that I think would be successful, and I don't think it would happen. I think we're more likely to see Alonso there next year than Schumacher. I think that it's been almost one of the worst kept secrets in the paddock that Alonso is heading that way, and I can't really see Schumacher coming back. I could see him winning races this year, and that being enough for him, proving that he's still got it and going again.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to see Alonso at Ferrari, but if Massa does end up coming back, which I still think at this point is questionable, I don't know if it would work out, because Massa has never been one to just lay over and let people walk all over him like Alonso has a reputation for doing. Alonso needs a teammate that is either A, bad, or is like a Rubens Barrichello, who's just going to lay over and let you do whatever. I don't think Schumacher will be back, but I don't know who they're going to take. If they do take Alonso, it won't last long.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I will be very surprised if we have a lineup, if we have a Massa Raikkonen lineup there next year. I think Massa will stay because he's cheap. Apparently he's good and cheap compared to Raikkonen. Raikkonen is being paid a king's ransom. It's hard to know. It's one of these things where maybe we're in a position where Michael will come back, he'll get the bug back and say, I want to do it again. You know, who knows? It's really, really difficult to tell right now.
We've seen comebacks in racing before, so I wouldn't be overly shocked if he did come back, but I don't expect it. As we mentioned, Alonso's current teammate, Nelson Piquet, is out at Renault, and his father, Nelson Piquet Sr., is reportedly going to buy back the BMW Sauber team with Peter Sauber to get his son a ride. So I don't know if they'll keep Bobby or Nick, but I would say 100% Nelson Piquet will be in the Sauber Piquet car next year.
Well, he'll only be 100% in the Sauber Piquet car if there's a Sauber Piquet team next year. There's a lot of ifs and buts there, but yeah, I think the fact that, for example, PKF1 has just been registered online as a domain name by PK's people. There's lots of reasons to think, I know that's sort of a vague one, but there's lots of reasons to think it will happen. PK's parting shot message on his website very much talked about how he's still going to be in F1 next year, so it sounded like there was a ring of confidence that he had about his place on the grid. So it's very possible, very, very possible.
Yep, I think as well it's a very real, realistic possibility for him. I think that, you know, I think that Renault did the right thing. I know I might not get a lot of fans for saying that, but I think Renault did the right thing, because oftentimes we see a lot of teams, you know, ditch guys after 1 year, you know, not really giving them a chance. Renault kept him at the end of the year, last year, after he had some decent runs, at the end, gave him another shot to see if he'd come around. About halfway through the season, he really has not progressed at all, from last year, and decided to cut him loose. Now, I hate to see it, because I don't hate Nelson Piquet Jr., and I think that he's, you know, he's a pretty decent driver, but, you know, I think it's also wrong, though, for Daddy just to be buying a team so his son keeps a ride. So I hope that's not the case, because that'd be disappointing.
I disagree with just about everything you said there. First off, Nelson Piquet fans, I don't think you're talking about the right Piquet, because Nelson Piquet Jr., you are not good. You are a bad driver, and you're only there because of your last name.
Oh, come on, Cole. Don't be so silly. Cole, he's not there only because of his last name. His pedigree in the junior formula is impeccable. It's absolutely impeccable. He has every right to be in F1. He had every right to get to F1. His career up to then merited an F1 shot. The fact that he didn't take it, or it didn't work out for him for whatever reason, he couldn't cope with the pressure, it does happen. Formula One has a reputation for eating people alive if they aren't capable mentally of standing up. It's done the same thing to Bourdais.
And the
fact that it's not about his name, it's about his money that helped him get started, but he had the talent to get there, but he didn't, unfortunately, like many drivers before me, the talent to get there, but he didn't have the talent to stay there, or the mental strength.
And you mentioned Bourdais. With Piquet being out at Renault, I know it would kind of go against if he has a Peugeot contract. But could we see Bourdais over at Renault?
No.
I don't think so. No way.
It'll be Grosjean.
I want Bourdais back. Sorry.
You'll get him in the IndyCar series.
No, we won't. Because Oriel Servia got that ride. But we already got through the IndyCar segment, so we won't... We won't go in there again because we already did the Bourdais rant that lasted about 10 minutes earlier. So we mentioned schedules earlier, and I just want to touch on that again because we didn't talk about Spa and Nürburgring might be going into rotation for the European GP starting soon. And may I just say that is bad. You can go to a place like Singapore, or you can go, you know, off in the Far East, but you can't go to Spa, or the Nürburgring, or Hockenheim, or Silverstone. That is the most convoluted, self-centered,
well,
Bernie FIA bureaucracy I've ever seen.
Well, I'm old school, and to me, Hockenheim is utterly anemic, and I can't stand the place. Hockenheim, as soon as they completely reconfigured the track, I lost interest. Hockenheim was wonderful, and now it's just rubbish. So, but yeah, the idea that Spa is not on the calendar every year is insane. absolutely insane.
Yep. You cannot switch those two tracks. You cannot go from having, you know, oh, well, we could just not go there at all, to, oh, how about we do the WRC and switch races every other year? You can't do that. You've seen what happened to places like Japan that's done that. I mean, now, talking about maybe even Britain doing something similar until Donington gets on its feet. You can't switch those races. And Hockenheim is junk. If you take away, it's just going to kill if you take away Spa. That's probably, the second, in some cases, first most popular race in the series. So, I mean, imagine taking away something like the Indy 500 or the Daytona 500 away from their respected series. And, I mean, you know, look at what you get. I mean, nothing.
Well, you see, because back to the point earlier about Bernie and Max having less power, and then you see stuff like that where the best pure driver's track, arguably, on the circuit, doesn't have a permanent place. Okay, granted, its facilities aren't fantastic, but they've been upgraded, but they're not world-class. But you know what? There are lots of places. Monaco has the worst facilities known to man. They're appalling. They're cramped. They shouldn't even be driving there if it wasn't. Obviously, it's got a massive tradition and it's very important, but there's lots of places that have terrible facilities. And it's scandalous, absolutely scandalous that they're not there.
Mm-hmm. And I know Hockenheim did get neutered a bit, but it, even though it is a crappy track and it got Herman Tilketized, it is still better than Singapore and Abu Dhabi and India and all these Far East ones that they have no tradition or culture of F1 over there. Don't get rid of the traditional European dates just to bring in more cash. I mean, you're killing F1 when you do that.
Yeah. I guess it's one of those things where I would rather have the tradition of Hockenheim over something like a Singapore. Granted, it's a night race, and they're the only, you know, clowns who would go along with Bernie and get that night race. So Bernie could finally shut up about it. But I think, you know, you can't do that. I mean, if they go through with this, it's going to be a disaster. We've already seen it in WRC. It's a disaster when you lose events like that. And then you may end up, losing the track altogether, like Monte Carlo. I mean, WRC thought about going back, but because they were talking about switching it around, I mean, they've lost them. The IRC is going to keep going back.
Well, Sean, WRC has already lost its Daytona 500. It's it doesn't have the Monte Carlo Rally on it anymore. It's going to alternate, which is scandalous. Mm-hmm. We had Ari Vatanen on our show last week, and he was. If you haven't heard the interview, just go on to www.radiolemon.com, and it's a standalone. You can go and listen to it. He's phenomenal, and he would be the best thing that would ever happen to the FIA if he gets in. But unfortunately, he won't. He won't get in. Sean Tull will get the job. But Ari would bring a little bit of sense to the FIA, and we'd see something approaching a sensible approach to rallying to F1. It's not going to happen, particularly rallying. Rallying is just was 20 years ago when I, well, 25, 30 years ago when I really got into motorsport first, maybe 30 years ago. Rallying and road racing were no different. They were equally as exciting. They were equally important motorsports to me. And mm-hmm. gradually, rallying has just eroded itself to the point where it's just annoying now. With super rally and it's just a load of old toss.
It's on toothpicks, that's for sure.
And I have never seen a rally race. There is no coverage of rallying in America. We have the HD Discovery thing, and I don't even get that channel here on Time Warner, so I don't know what I'm going to do if I want to see it. So,
Mobile won the grid last week, had coverage of the New England round of the American Rally Championship, which was quite good.
Thank you.
and a great, great chat with Travis Pastrana. The only rallying, of course, you get to see is the very exciting but utterly contrived X Games rally.
Which, it was great to see Kenny Breck come and win that. I've always liked Kenny, and it was good to see him win that, so congrats to him. in the X Games rally, even though he didn't really have to compete for it. It just kind of got handed to him there at the end.
Like Travis Brown running out of talent.
Mm-hmm. Sudden lack of talent disorder.
That was embarrassing.
Lose to a guy who hasn't had a single ounce of rally experience.
That Fiesta was mean. That Fiesta was just brutal.
That was the Pussycat Fiesta. That wasn't the one that they took to Pikes Peak. The Pikes Peak one had about 400 horsepower more than that one was about 550, and the Pikes Peak one had 900. But of course, the best machine at Pikes Peak was probably the Mark II Racing RS 200, which had 900 in basic trim, plus 70 litres of NOS, which gave it, as the air got thin up the top of the mountain, it gave it about 1175 bhp. So it was that's just the greatest event in the world, Pikes Peak.
I'd love to see that again, or ever. I've never seen it. I've read about it before with the Unsers and things.
If you've never gone online and just type in Ari Vatanen climb dance into YouTube, you will see, and I'm not making this up, the greatest piece of motorsport footage ever committed to film.
Uh-huh.
You will be blown away by it.
I would not completely agree with that. Have you ever seen Thomas Schechter in 2004 at the Indy 500? That was a piece of drive.
You really, really, really have to open your eyes and embrace the broader motorsport world. As we're talking, I'm going to find you the clip and I'm going to send it to you. And let's listen to you as we watch it live on air. It's absolutely incredible.
Okay, well, go ahead and send it to me, and we'll have a little commentary in our podcast here about the video. So we will take a little break here, and when we come back, I guess we'll have some commentary, some more commentary from the guys. So stick around for that.
Well, your commentary will be basically you going, "Dear God, my God, look at that."
And welcome back from that short intermission there. I had to be shown a video by the incomparable Declan Brennan of the world's best piece of driving I have ever seen in my life, and I think I've now been converted into a rallying fan after seeing this video. I'll post it on the main page tonight also, so you can see what my eyes have just witnessed. It was the most glorious piece of driving, and it was by the future FIA, the non-future FIA, the way they might want to make it sound, President Ari Vatanen.
See, one of the things about that era is, well, that's the late 80s, what happened was, with the banning of the Group B cars, which again, you being in America and not being a rallying, being sort of exposed to rallying, you missed one of the most exciting times in all of motorsport when Group B came along, because it was these rocket ships running on public roads around Europe, and they really were just extraordinary machines. But they got banned for a number of reasons. One is they were ludicrously dangerous and were killing people, driving into people on the sides of the roads, etc. So they had to find other things to do with them. So Audi decided, I know what we'll do, we'll take one to Pikes Peak. So they took one in, I think it was 86 was the first year, and they took it with Michel Mouton, who was Danica Patrick before Danica Patrick was, but good. And actually won races. She nearly won the 82. She was just pipped to the 82 World Rally Championship. Now, to Danica, be regularly competitive as opposed to just tootling around in the mid regions of the top 10. So Mouton went to Pikes Peak and caused masses of confusion because she took her co-driver with her and they pace noted it. And so the first team ever to actually take pace notes up the hill, and they took a factory Audi and broke the course record, and that just opened the floodgates for the factory teams in the late 80s, and they all did it, and then they hired people like Bobby Unser to go and do it, and fantastic time for effectively rallying in North America. Anyway, enough of the history lesson.
Yeah, what'd you think of Marcus running up the old mountain, even though he had some problems?
I don't know if you listen to our show, and if you don't, I'm going to have you shot. But he came on the week, literally on the Tuesday before his run, and he was excited about it. But I think, along with both himself and Mark Renison in the Mark II car, it just worked out that they just don't fundamentally get enough time to do. Any time you go up the mountain in year one, you really are going up to learn it. They're not going to beat the monster up there who's now been doing it for so many years. But next year, maybe they'll go back. I'd love to see one of them. I'd love to see somebody like Granholm or Renison in the RS200 beat the 10-minute mark. That would be just stunning. Because those cars are effectively like drag racers. Mark was telling us that with the RS200, he described it as being a 10-minute car. Like the way a drag racer literally is built to go for five seconds, and then it has to be rebuilt, and it'll go again. The Pikes Peak cars are literally built to go for 10 minutes and then they fall apart. So it's an extraordinary event and should get more publicity than it does.
Yeah, as I was saying before, you know, after seeing that video, I might have to just dig around and find it because I think I've now been converted into a rally car fan. So thanks a lot, guys. Another sport to follow.
The other one you have to watch, and I'll send it to you, that you have to put up on your site is Walter Roll.
Oh, no, Dex, we can't be putting your stuff on our site. You have your own site now.
Oh, no, I'm just a guest. I'm just a guest blogger. Guest blogger on air. Poor man has blog envy, ladies and gentlemen. We trade him for that.
No, it's all in good fun. So are there any more topics you guys want to touch on? I've completed my list of topics.
I'm speechless. I have to save up for the Open Paddock show.
Yeah. Anything from you, Dex? Any other topics you want to touch on?
We should really have a chat about USF1, shouldn't we, at some point? Glorious rumors. And a very, very good source who in turn has very, very reliable sources told me a very interesting story about what they believe to be the money that is being set aside for Danica Patrick's contract and personal services deal with Ganassi, but he also told me he had heard a separate rumor that to be perfectly honest, he didn't quite hold the same or feel that it was as much validity, and that was that USF1 are considering the two target chip Ganassi drivers for next year.
What? Wow. I sincerely doubt that, but I've said before, if any of you subscribe to Racer Magazine, you would have seen the Jonathan Summerton article. He's going to go far, and I think he will be in F1 next year. He was taken over on their trip that they had a few other drivers on. If not in a testing role next year, I think he will be one of the people.
I know Jonathan. I was chatting to him at Lime Rock. I've chatted to him a number of times on the phone recently. Jonathan hasn't done enough this year. Jonathan really had to have done more this year than he's done. Jonathan's getting his ass kicked by a girl, and I'm not saying there's something wrong with that, she's a very, very good girl, but he's getting his ass kicked by her. She blew them away at Lime Rock. I was there, and she was amazing, and that girl's going far. She's going to GP2 next year. Robert Clark is her manager. Same manager as Tony Kanaan. She'll win the $1 million, she'll take it to GP2. Jonathan should, if he's got any hopes of making it in F1, he's got to be winning a series like Atlantics with a relatively weakened field. And it's not full grids, and he's not quite doing it, and that's got to be a worry.
And we saw him in Indy Lights at the beginning of the season, and he wasn't really setting the world on fire. But
although he did say to me that he felt that one of the problems with Indy Lights was this year, particularly on road courses, that if you're not in an AGR AFS car, then you might as well not bother. And I think that is actually being played out a little bit this year. That team is particularly dominant.
Yeah, go ahead.
It looks like for the USF1, what about, look at old little boy Rossi, going to get that drive in that BMW?
Oh, it's I'm glad you mentioned him. I have a piece appearing today. I had a lovely conversation with him about 6 weeks ago, and we did a long afternoon's chat, which has turned into a feature, which is on Speed TV, right, literally appeared today. And he's probably a couple of years away. I don't think in his mind he feels that he's ready for it. He certainly wouldn't be able to make the jump now from International Formula Master. He'd have to be looking at probably next year. International Formula Master becomes GP3 next year, and I think he's considering staying there, if not moving to F2. GP2, it would give him a little bit more time to get used to Europe. GP2 is where he wants to get to before F1. on saying that he feels he might be in a test role next year for USF1. And he's winning races in Europe now, which is encouraging, and that's good. He's not winning enough, but he is winning now. So
I'm going to go ahead and I think this is all the topics. So to close out here, I'd just like to ask your opinion on, as a final closer question, if you are Peter Windsor and Ken Anderson and you could hire any American driver out there right now, even if they're under contract, who would you pick? We'll start with Sean.
Put me on the spot. You go first, Dex. I got to think.
No, he asked you first. Go ahead. I want to think.
Well, maybe I should answer first then.
Yeah, well, then you answer first.
I'm going to go out on a limb and pick Ryan Hunter-Reay. And I know Dex is going to shoot me down because he's not the biggest IRL guy in the world. But
are you kidding me? Have you ever heard of my show? I've been saying for 5 years that he's the best, best American road racer.
I met him Saturday at Kentucky, and he was probably one of the top five nicest guys down there that I talked to. And he's good. He has a good personality, and I think he's exceptionally well at getting sponsors, which a lot of American drivers don't do as well as Brazilians and Europeans. And I think, if he wants it, I think they should be one of the guys that they should look at.
I'd love to see Ryan Hunter-Reay. I think the problem is there really just simply isn't anybody with enough experience. I think Hildebrand could be a good opportunity or good choice. The problem is the guys I think maybe who really have the talent are probably too far away. They're down the ladder. That's Newgarden, Daly, and Rossi. So it means that if you're going to pick a guy, you've got to go with somebody who's a little older, like it'd be a Ryan Hunter-Reay. I'm not sure. Hildebrand might have the talent. I really like Jonathan. Jonathan, I'm not sure, is up to the task. Marco certainly isn't. He's got to grow up.
Oh, Lord.
To be fair, because I don't think Graham Rahal is right now. Graham Rahal still is a bit of... He's showing in IndyCar that he's just... His racecraft doesn't seem to be there yet. His head doesn't quite seem to be there. So I would say Hunter-Reay would be an interesting choice. But for two North Americans, any North Americans, let me see. I could shock you and say something crazy like Pat Long.
Or Villeneuve.
Or
old JV.
No.
No, Pat Long. Pat Long and Hunter-Reay.
I like Pat. He really got the short end of the stick on the Porsche deal there. When they changed over to Grand Am, and I was not a big fan of that move because I think he's one of the good up and comers. So I agree with that. So Sean, who's your pick?
Well, I'd say I'm kind of with Dex. The drivers I want don't quite have the experience, because I would pick if they were there, I'd pick Rossi, but he's not there, and Daly as well. But I'd have to say that. It would be, forget it. I would pick Hunter-Reay, and I'd pick Rossi, whether he's there or not. I'd pick him. And that's just being a fanboy. So.
Wow. I'd love to see Daly in Newgarden.
Yeah.
I think Newgarden is a fantastic talent. Newgarden's doing an unbelievable job this year, considering his team boss died early on in the season. The poor guy went through a lot. His team boss, a very young man, Joe Tandy, was killed in a car accident, and he's actually been winning since. He's done a remarkable job. You may not know this, but he also entered some Slicks and Wings events in Britain in the Formula Parmarodi series, which is sort of like a dumbed down version of F2, which is actually where Justin Wilson came from originally, and he's won races in that. So this kid has a lot of talent.
Can I make a change?
Go ahead.
I'd fire Ryan Hunter-Reay, and I'd hire Graham Rahal instead.
If I'm already
picking Rossi, and
I'm not sure you understand how this works. You can't ask for people's opinion and then just shout no at them.
Well, if it's Danica or Rahal, I'm going to shout no anyways because I don't like them at all.
Well, you're lucky because I could have went with my personal favorite IndyCar driver and picked Marco, but I didn't because I know he's not.
Throw out another name for you as well, who could well feature in the future, and that would be John Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
John Edwards is winning in Atlantics. John Edwards won the Star Mazda series last year. John Edwards won the Star Mazda series last year. And he fended off a very strong mid-season charge by Peter Dempsey, who started really getting to grips with the series, and kept his head and really, really impressed me, and won the title. And he's now maturing, and he's doing very well in Atlantics. He could still win the title in Atlantics. So Simone de Silvestro doesn't have it wrapped up. So John Edwards is somebody to watch. I think the future of USF1 for American drivers in the next 3 or 4 years is actually pretty good. It's just unfortunately now it's just going to be impossible for him to take two US drivers into F1 right now. If he wants to develop the car, he can't do that. He needs to have somebody with experience.
Villeneuve. If I'm going to build a team from year one, I think he'd be a smart option.
Any good? When was the last time he did anything any good for anybody?
He is an epic failure of a driver, but he does.
People go bad. Drivers go off like milk. He got ousted at BMW because he wasn't as good as Kubica. Kubica as a rookie outshone him. He did nothing when he had his stint at Renault. He did nothing the year before with Sauber. He hasn't done anything in years. He's a spent force.
Yeah.
He may well, but we're not going for results. We're going for that veteran that can test.
Then you get a guy who's a great test driver. So you get the guy who just won Le Mans from Austria, whose name, for some reason, my mind has just gone completely blank. Ex-Benetton driver, Williams test driver.
Genet?
No,
not him. Oh, my bad.
God, what's happening? My mind's... We'll think of it in a second. But Alex Wurz. You'll get Alex.
Yeah, Alex Wurz.
I've heard him rumored to Manor as well, so...
I heard Wurz over JV at USF1, or at least for a choice, because even though he hasn't... Even though you're not looking to win, I mean, JV's going to be looking to win because that's what he does, and he's going to complain, and... He's just washed up. He just needs to move on. He can't even do NASCAR, for crying out loud.
And I do want to throw one more name out, and he's practically American by now, and I know everyone that reads the blog and listens a lot. And I know everyone that reads and listens a lot is going to roll their eyes when I say this, but Sebastian Bourdais at USF1 would work. Because Sebastian Bourdais rocks.
I've just shot you in my mind.
See, I love this idea. Yeah, because you can imagine the press conference. Yes, and we did say we're going to have two American drivers. So our two American drivers are Jonathan Summerton and Sebastian Bourdais. Well, he's sort of American. He's been to America. He likes records with a band, America.
I can't get any respect as a Bourdais fan anymore.
No, you know what?
Poor fella.
I'd love to see. Genuinely, I think he got it. He had a bad time. He got it in his head. He went from a situation where he was the top dog, both at Newman Haas and in the series, and he went to a situation where he was struggling and under pressure for his job, and it didn't work out for him. He nailed himself into his own coffin, if that's possible, through some sort of weird device where you can stick your arm out of the coffin and get rid of the coffin. Obviously, note to self, doesn't actually exist. The problem was that this year, and we said it before, he got beaten too regularly by his 7-year-old teammate, and you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. And I think if he would have started out at a team like Ferrari, even though that's not going to happen, I think if he would have started out at a good team, he would have done well. But he needs to be in a good car if he's going to do well. That's just his mindset.
Yeah, agreed.
And I think that just about covers all of the topics on this rather long F1 segment of the podcast. So we'll move into our final segment with Lisa and I sharing some of our experiences from Kentucky. So I want to thank Declan Brennan and Sean Peckin for their help on the podcast. And so stick around for our next segment.
Welcome to the Planet IRL segment, where we're going to discuss our experiences at Kentucky Motor Speedway this weekend. Both Cole and myself had the advantage of going down into the pit lanes, and we have some very exciting and fun stories. So we're going to do this more informal and just chat through some of our experiences that we had over the weekend.
Yeah, it was the first time I was in the garages. I think you've been in once before, and it was probably the coolest race experience I've ever been a part of. We met a lot of personalities, and it was really fun to meet up with you, and we're already planning a bigger meetup with the whole team coming up next year, so that's exciting.
Definitely. It's always fun putting a name to the face, so it was great meeting you, and thank you very much for extending me one of your pit passes. It was a great time.
Well, it was an honor to have you as a race buddy for the weekend. I'll be in the pits, and I think Steve, as we talked to earlier, will also be in the pits at Mid-Ohio, and we have a couple interviews we're talking about getting while we're down there, so that'll be very exciting. We have a couple stories we'd like to share with you, and I think I'm going to first let Lisa tell a special story about Ryan Hunter Ray and how we came to meet him.
Yeah, I will give Cole credit. He has a very good eye for catching the drivers. I, of course, as many of my Twitter followers know, had my eyes out for one driver in particular, which Cole, of course, always spotted. I think the three times we actually saw him, you pointed out Will Power to me. So luckily you were there, and I didn't miss my opportunity. But the Ryan Hunter Ray story was pretty great. So, you know, me and Cole were just doing laps around the garages and looking at the cars, and all of a sudden here comes Cole with, "Hey, I think I just saw Ryan Hunter Ray walk into the men's room and go into the urinals." So, you know, of course, me just being bold was like, "All right, great. Well, we're going to stand right outside the men's room and I'm waiting for him to come out." And that's surely what we did. So the poor guy was pretty much ambushed the minute he walked out of the bathroom. But, you know, that's how I roll. So yeah. He was very nice and, you know, got a picture with him, talked to him for a few minutes, gave him some South Florida love since he does live about 30 minutes down the road from me. So that was a really cool sighting.
Yeah. Well, I saw him and Lisa's like, "Well, wait right outside the bathroom door with the camera ready inside the men's room at a racetrack." I'm like, "You go ahead." I just kind of wandered off a few feet away acting like I didn't know who she was, but it was fun. And, she got her hit in on me there. So I'll take a shot at her here. We were over in front of the Penske haulers and there's a group of people there and I'm like, "Oh my gosh, it's Rick Mears." And, one certain lady, whom I shall name, just happened to not know who Rick Mears is out of the pack of three or four people that were there. So she almost embarrassed me in that moment, not knowing who a god is, a four-time Indy winner.
It was Lanica. It was the multiple personality there. I blame Lanica. No comment.
You always blame Lanica.
But then again, I did get Rick to turn around and wave to us because mm-hmm. a certain somebody was too chicken to even yell his name out. So, you know, we got him eating his golden Penske hot dog photo. And, you know, as he was walking off, I was sure to yell so that you could at least kind of wave and say hi.
it was an awesome experience to be within the presence of a legend like himself. And Tim Sindrick was also there, and we saw a fair amount of all the drivers and personalities around the series, and including Kevin Lee, our buddy from Trackside, who actually knew Planet IRL was. That was very exciting, and I got a picture with him. Of course, Lisa was the one that went up and introduced us, because I just know everyone. She's the talkative one of the bunch.
I know. We need to work on that, Cole. Cole would just point people out, which, I mean, it was great meeting Kevin. And, of course, I would have had no idea what he looked like just walking in the crowd. So, you know, I was pretty much the, "Hey, just yell people's names out and get them to turn around and look." So it was pretty cool meeting Kevin. We appreciate him for his time and stopping and chatting with us for a little bit. So that was pretty cool. So I guess kind of moving into some other stories, let's see. Of course, I will have to take a moment to talk about my lovely photog opportunity with the one and only Will Power. As most of you know, that was pretty much my mission for the weekend in the pits, was running into him. So thanks to Cole, who we were actually standing kind of to the side of the garages where a lot of the cars were coming through for the tech inspection, and a lot of the drivers were going back through to where their motorhomes were. So we thought that was a good little opportunity to see some folks, but then, you know, kind of got bored standing around. So Cole was like, well, let's go do another lap. And it could not have been better timing, because literally the minute we walked by the Penske truck, here came Will Power out. So he took a minute. You could tell, obviously, he was extremely busy. He was trying to run off, but Lanica was not going to let that happen. So after he signed somebody else's autograph and was trying to jump on his scooter, I pretty much just said, hey, Will, picture, and just threw my arm around his waist. He wasn't getting away from me.
I had to wipe the drool off of her chin at one point.
I don't think there was drool, but I was pretty excited, and I do remember jumping up and down after he drove off on his scooter. So
no,
I was
no joking. She was actually hopping up and down in the middle of the garages.
I did. I think I even made some joke that I won't wash my shirt I was wearing, but I'm not going to be that fanatical. So, but that was definitely a really cool sighting. So glad we got to at least see him and get a picture with him. Didn't have much time to chat with him, obviously, with all of the pre-race melee going on, but that obviously was a high point for me in the pit area.
Yeah, speaking of that shirt, I just want to point out the brilliance of Lisa and I. She came especially wearing a black sweater to a race that was at least 80 degrees, and I had
hey, come on, I'm Florida, and the weather report said 60 that evening.
Yeah, it was very hot, and we were both very, very hot standing in the pits, but that's okay. It was so worth it to see Dan.
Wait real quick to add to that. So here's Cole also telling me you must wear long pants to go into the pits. And so Friday when I went there for what turned out to not be qualifying or practice, I did see all the people going down there with shorts. So unfortunately, I didn't pack anything other than jeans. But at least we have a note for self next time that pants are not required, so we can be a little bit cooler for summer races.
But it was all worth it in the end, because as soon as we came out of the tunnel and went up into the garage area, there comes Danica whizzing by on her scooter like they all do at about 90,000 miles an hour.
Oh my gosh.
And I have a lovely picture of our Lanica giving Danica the finger as she rode back, but I don't think we'll publicize that one. But
that was great. Come on, at least there wasn't a cat fight going on.
And she was, however, to start another rumor here, riding with Chip Ganassi right next to her. So, you know, let the rumors begin.
And then we saw him later kind of scooting through the crowd. He didn't look too happy, though. He looked very, very serious.
I've never seen Chip Ganassi. He's always like, "Urgh."
Yeah, he looked like it, too. He looked like he was ready to kill somebody.
I met him at Indy a couple years ago. He was just as pleasant. We also saw Jimmy Vassar a couple times. He gave us a good thumbs up.
We did, even though he looked a little intoxicated on the vino.
He was a bit, he looked a bit tipsy, but he's Jimmy Vassar and he's allowed to.
Yeah, we love him anyway, so that was cool. We kind of saw him on the front side of the garage, yelled out, he gave us a thumbs up, and then when we went around to the back side, we were sure to kind of poke our head in the door where he was sitting and say a couple words to him, so that was pretty funny.
And, of course, Lisa had to get the picture with all the drivers and the personalities and, all, you know, Will Power and Ryan Hunter Ray and the pictures with everybody. And I got one picture with one driver, of a very, very notable driver. Jacques Lazier was kind enough to spare a moment from his huge fan club to come and get a picture with me. And it was very touching. And it's now my new Twitter picture, so go check that out.
It is. I think it was cool. We got to give some love to Jacques. Come on.
I feel bad for the guy. I really do. And I'd like to meet him again and maybe interview him sometime, because he was probably the nicest driver down there. And poor guy just has to park the car after a lap because they can't afford fuel or tires. But...
So. And we can't forget the also met EJ Visa, so that was pretty cool. Again, just happened to be walking by the hauler, and literally nobody was around, and he just poked his head out the sliding glass door. So
Lanica,
that is my opportunity to say, hey, EJ, picture. And it was kind of funny. Cole can attest to it, because he kind of looked like, okay, and then I was like, no, as in with me, to like clarify it. He was more than gracious and came out. Of course, he was
came out. We were practically in his trailer by the time we got the picture. So.
Well, we gotta at least give the shout out that he was pretty much standing on the step to the trailer. Because if you look at the photo, there's no way that guy is taller than me, and I'm 5'8". So that was pretty funny. He definitely had a little advantage on the height there in that picture, but he was really nice. So that was cool seeing him as well.
Yeah. We also saw J.R. Hildebrand. We didn't have any idea who the poor guy was, because I don't really watch lights much, and Lisa doesn't at all, I don't believe. And he just walks right past us after he had won the race, and we're like, hey, and he's like, hey, and we're like, who are you?
Well, and the picture I got was great, because we happened to be standing where they were giving away the awards for the FIL race, and literally I'm like standing right by the walkway, and he's coming straight at me. I'm just taking a picture like, ooh, there's a driver. And I mean, he's just smiling, walking right up to me into the photo, and me and Cole are both sitting there like, all right, I don't know who that was, but hey, I think my comment was, he's kind of cute. And
mm-hmm.
of course Cole does his, yeah, and he's like, what, 20 years younger than you? And Cole likes to point out the fact that a lot of his followers on Twitter are old, even though some of us are not quite that old, Cole.
You're old enough to be J.R. Hildebrand's mother, so.
No, I don't think so. How old is that guy? If I had him, maybe when I was like 10.
Yeah. We saw Anna B. and Sam Schmidt while we were down there, too, so that was pretty cool. Anything else? Any other stories I'm missing?
I'm trying to think. I think that pretty much wrapped it up. I mean, it was, you know, I think we saw other drivers kind of coming and going. I love how you mentioned, and I put it in my blog update about how fast those guys come whizzing around on those scooters. I remember at one point, me and Cole kind of found what we thought was the back door by all the haulers where the drivers were. Instead of coming out in the main fairway, they would kind of sneak out back and then go whizzing by on their scooters. And I swear we were like almost roadkill by Willpower and TK at that one point. You do not see them coming around those corners. It's pretty funny.
Willpower almost ran me over. I almost tackled Lisa to get out of the way there. So
I know. And then of course you again with the eye was like, there's Willpower. So I did yell his name and he kind of turned back a little bit and gave a wave. So that was, I think, encounter two. And then of course the third was when he was talking to Rick Mears, who I know I'll never live that one down, but did not recognize the guy.
You did not know who Rick Mears is. That's a sin.
I know who he is. I didn't recognize him. Leave me alone. I'll take that one to my grave.
He's so. Rick Mears. You're never gonna get over that. But
I know.
We just wanted to come on and share some stories with you. So I want to thank Lisa for coming and hanging in the pits with me this week. I hope she enjoyed it as much as I did. And I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in and listening to us and reading the blog. So anything you want to follow up here, Lisa?
No, absolutely. Like I said, it was awesome meeting you. We had an amazing time for 2 hours doing our stalkerazzi-ing in the IRL garages. So it was a lot of fun, and looking forward to the next race that, you know, you and I meet up and hopefully the rest of the Planet IRL team. And as Cole said, thanks as always for listening to us, and we'll talk to you later.
Yeah, we're planning a meetup next year at possibly Texas or Chicago. So we'll keep you informed on that and maybe invite some of you out to that.
Oh, and I did think of one other shout out to give. Wanted to give a shout out to Vision for having their tweet up. We met Mike and Patricia, and they gave us some great free race swag. So definitely, that was cool too. Forgot about that.
So thanks to them and hanging out at the tweet up. And I suggest you all go follow them and hang out at the tweet up. I'll be there next week at the Vision tweet up at Mid Ohio. So come check that out and maybe say hey to me. As always, check out planet-irl.com for all your racing news and opinions, including the forum, the race chat, and submit your own photos. That's where our photos are from Kentucky, Lisa, including the Phil Spector impersonator that we met. So go and check that out.
Gotta give a shout out to Phil. I mean, hands down, that guy is the indie fan of 2009.
Well, I think that wraps it up. So I want to thank all the members who came on the podcast this week. And thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in next week on the PlanetIRL.com podcast.
Oh, the back crash! No, another crash, and it's upside down. We've got a car upside down. It's Marco Andretti.
Marco, you okay?
There are extra.
actually seven previous winners of the Monaco Grand Prix starting in tomorrow's race, and four of them are Michael Schumacher.
All right, pit this lap. Watch the speed limit. 3, 2, 1. Watch right here.
A lot of people here are really debating whether Ricardo Rossi is Formula One material.
Well, that's a fairly short debate, mate.
I am so annoyed. Well, I can't tell you how annoyed I am. I just can't believe that we had the problems that we had in Brazil. And I come here and we have even more damn problems. So, you know, the car should not be where it is.